Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Look up tonight. That steady glow has guided, haunted, and inspired humanity since the beginning, and it's the star of Christopher Kokinos' luminous book, Stella's Bright. An award-winning poet and essayist, Kokinos takes us on a journey across time and space, from ancient lunar myths to Galileo's telescope, from obsessive 19th century moon mappers to the astronauts of Apollo and now Artemis.
But this isn't just science or history. Turning his own telescope skyward during a season of loss and change, he discovers solace, love, and wonder in the moon's enduring light. Part natural history, part space story, part memoir, Stella's Bright will change the way you see the night sky. Christopher Kokinos, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, let's just start with changing the way that we see the night sky. I think we all want to be inspired by the night sky, and somehow many of us are guilty of not even looking up at night, or maybe not even being outside at night to be able to look up. But we want that for some reason. Can you just explore that a bit?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's true. I think we're so... We're so scheduled into very busy lives, and we're so habituated to screen time that we do forget to look up. And, you know, we also have a lot of lights around us in you know, where most of us live, certainly not the case out in the rural parts of America and around the world, where you can still see the Milky Way. I've been, you know, with people who have never seen the Milky Way, who are as old as I am in their 50s or 60s. And so that's almost criminal. You know? So my hope and my urge is, yeah, go outside and take a look. And the moon is there. Despite light pollution, you can see the moon clearly. It shines brightly over the mountains and over villages, over all of us, all of humanity. And as Scott suggested, it's been doing that for a long time. We have a deep relationship to the moon. And so, you know, my sort of message, or, you know, one of the things that I wanted to convey in Stella's Bright is how beautiful the moon is and how much there is for us to know about it, because the importance of the moon early in our species history was manifold, and we've lost that. Now we're going back in, as explorers. That's a different sort of approach. They're all valid, all interesting. But I do encourage people to go out and take a look. And if you happen to be in a place where your public library has a telescope borrowing program, do that and take a look at the moon through a telescope. You will gasp. I've shown people craters of the moon through a telescope, and they all shout and scream, and it's pretty incredible.
I'm wondering about your personal story and connection to the moon. Were you someone who gazed up into the night sky as a kid?
Yeah, I was, and I was, you know, I was a child of Apollo. I remember watching the moon landing when it's one of my, probably my most vivid childhood memory from that time, watching the landing unfold on television. And I had a little cardboard, like paper lunar lander that my parents had constructed for me. So I was flying it around the kitchen while the real thing was happening. You know, but I lost that sense of childhood wonder. That is something that the book is after, how we can recultivate that sense of childhood wonder, not just for ourselves individually, but as a foundation for sort of ethical practice in our very complicated and chaotic society. That's another topic. But I came to the moon after many years of stargazing when I was living first in Utah, here in northern Utah. I moved to Tucson, where there are city lights. And so I wasn't looking at the stars as much. My telescope was dusty and unused, and I was just not at a very good point in my life. I hauled the telescope out. There was the moon. And, you know, it was transformative to have, you know, this incredibly sharp view of this world that is over us every month. That sort of brought me back to the moon, and I fell in love with its history and the fact that it's a place, and that you can guide yourself and navigate around the surface of the moon through a telescope and see where the Apollo astronauts landed. You can, you know, look at these craters that are named for philosophers, for scientists, for artists, and that helps sort of open up the moon as an archive as well. A kind of archive of story and feeling, I guess I would say. Yeah.
You talk about the moon's history a bit, and the moon has been both a scientific object and a cultural symbol as well. I mean, how did you end up balancing the astronomy and mythology, art and humanity throughout the book?
Well, I taught writing for a long time, and I used to tell my students that chronology is your friend, and that just taking it through the, that span from antiquity or, even prehistory up to the present moment really was how I could organize the book in a coherent fashion. Because, as Lynn was saying, it is a book about the moon. It's a book about a relationship with the moon, but it's also a personal story. I joke that it's a book about a boy and his telescope. And at one point I'm sort of renovating and cleaning up and recalibrating a telescope that I had as a child that my father had given me. He dies during the course of the book. So there is that personal element. Those questions of mortality are deeply embedded in our relationship to the moon. After all, it rises, it grows full, it disappears. And some of the, so early mythology is about the moon as this god or goddess that dies and is resurrected. So I just wanted to follow and honor and bear witness and sort of give respect to those ancient traditions. And there are people today still who, of course, worship the moon. So I tried to balance from prehistory all the way to this present moment where we are launching on a rocket and going to the moon for the first time in more than 50 years. So that is a lot to put your arms around. And so I tried in the book to give readers at least a sense of that global, manifold, deep historical relationship, folkloric, artistic, religious, cultural, with the moon. It still, of course, matters to many people around the world as a sacred object. And now we've moved into this era of exploration.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of the moon. I mean, in antiquity, the moon was one of the most important mysterious objects in the sky. And I'm curious, what surprised you most about how early civilizations understood or even misunderstood the moon?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that I would say one of the things I'd like to think about when looking at prehistory in particular, the moon as a timepiece, right? So it becomes this way of marking time, literally, like on rock or on bone in cultures around the world, between the daily cycle and the seasonal cycle. And so you have cultures around the world who are keeping track of moon phases. This is actually really sophisticated natural science that they're doing, right? I think most of us would be hard pressed to go outside, know what phase the moon is in, and know where it is in the sky because it moves around a lot. So we've got pre, quote unquote, literate cultures doing science of timekeeping with the moon. That's deeply impressive. And so I was really struck by that. And one of the other things that I found really compelling was that as we move into the era of sort of classic ancient Greek and Middle Eastern philosophy, the idea that the moon was a perfect sphere that could also have been a mirror, so that the surface of the earth is somehow reflected on the waters of the moon back to the earth. And I just love that image that the moon is a reflection of who we are. And of course, it isn't figuratively. There's no surface water on the moon, but it is. It is a sort of mirror to our desires, our hopes, and our fears.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science journalist and essayist Christopher Kokinos. We're talking to him about his book about the moon. It's called Still as Bright. We're also talking in advance of the Artemis II launch, now delayed until early March. It was to have launched this week, but due to a hydrogen leak, again, that launch is postponed till early March at this point. But the Artemis II mission will be the first human mission to the moon in 50 years. Christopher, tell us a little bit about your background. You're in Utah now, but you haven't always been. Why did you come back?
I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana, not a place of sublime landscapes, just to be gentle about that. And so I looked at the night sky and, like a lot of kids, wanted to be an astronaut, all of those things. And so the sky over Indiana was maybe the only source of the sublime for me when I was a kid, whether it was looking at the moon through my tiny telescope or watching thunderheads and tornado weather. But I moved from the Midwest. My teaching career brought me to Utah State many years ago. And so we were here for a long time, and I was using my telescope out in the rural part of Cache Valley, looking at galaxies and, basically anything but the moon. The moon was sort of an annoyance, right? Because it's so bright. So I just ignored the moon for a long time. But when we moved to Tucson, I took a job at the University of Arizona, and we were living in the city. And so that's when I rediscovered the moon. And then took early retirement and came back to Utah just a few years ago, sort of post-COVID during that time. Yeah, so we're
Okay.
back in Logan.
And it's so funny that you say that, Christopher, because my sweet husband got me a telescope for Christmas. And
Awesome.
I keep thinking, oh, I'll wait until there's no moon, to look at the stars, which is such a mistake. And
That's
you
not mutually exclusive.
exactly. You can do it in all stages of the moon, right? In that night sky, especially in advance of the Artemis II mission. So we've just said that the February 6th launch date is delayed due to a hydrogen leak. What are the other considerations around launching Artemis II?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, and there are aspects of this that I think people haven't really reported or paid attention to. So I've also been covering Artemis II for Astronomy Magazine. I'll be there at the launch, fingers crossed, assuming the weather works, and they have to load the vehicle with propellant, make sure there are no leaks. It took a long time when they did the test flight about 3 years ago to get that done. So there are a lot of those variables, and then it has to do with where the moon is and when you launch. There's a complicated set of equations and numbers called lunar theory, and it was worked out in the 19th century. And this is basically understanding where the moon is at any given point in relation to the Earth. Now, we just normally think it's like 250,000 miles away. Well, it moves around a lot, and so they have to take all of that into consideration, and the heat shield. So with the Artemis 1 mission, there were some anomalies with the heat shield. It did not change the cabin environment. It would have been safe for humans to come back, but things happened that they didn't expect. There was some melting and bubbling and ablation that they weren't expecting on that heat shield. So fast forward to Artemis 2. You're putting four human beings on this, Christina Cook, Victor Glover, Reid Wiseman, Jeremy Hansen, and they want it to be absolutely safe. So they altered the heat shield design a little bit, but they also altered the reentry trajectory. So this craft is coming back very quickly, multiple thousands of miles an hour. So the launch windows are constrained by not only where the moon is, but how they will reenter the Earth's atmosphere. So they're going to do something called a skip trajectory, where they hit the atmosphere of the Earth, kind of bounce, come back, like a little leap on a skateboard. Okay. And so there are ways they can do that only within certain launch windows. So that's a kind of complicated explanation for what looks like a fairly narrow band, in early February, early March, early April. So a few days in those 3 months.
Christopher, you have me very excited about Artemis 2 right now. I'm really looking forward to this. The way you're describing this, it's exciting. But I want to actually go back in time a little bit. I want to talk about the Apollo missions and how they transformed the moon from an unreachable mystery into a place where we've actually walked on it. So in your view, how did that episode, how did that time in our lives, how did it shift the effect of science and even our current culture?
It's a great question, and it's a fascinating one when you look at the excitement that was built into those early Apollo missions, right? As you and listeners may know, then some a lot of that initial excitement waned very quickly. We met the goal. It was a geopolitical goal. I mean, first and foremost, President Kennedy was, not particularly interested in space. He wanted to find something that would demonstrate to the developing world that the US system was superior to the Soviet system. The Soviets were sending more people. They beat us to space with the satellite, with a human being. And so Kennedy decides, all right, we'll do this moonshot. And none of that is to take away. I mean, it was an incredible effort. It was a monumental effort. 400,000 people, multiple human beings getting to the moon and coming back safely. Apollo 13, of course, was dubbed a successful failure because they had a catastrophic explosion. They came back. They were alive. They were safe. But Apollo opened up the moon to us as a place of scientific exploration. And even though public interest waned over the course of the Apollo program, that science that they did, especially from Apollo 15, 16, and 17, which were true scientific expeditions, and I tell the story of Apollo 15 in the book, they brought back samples that weren't opened until a few years ago. And in opening those samples and bringing new technology to bear on them, that's one of the things that happened that's caused this new lunar revival. We found that there were water molecules inside these moon rocks. So it's a weird kind of full circle in talking about prehistory, where those darkish spots that you can see with your eye, they're called maria, right? That's Latin for seas. And so we thought there was surface water on the moon. Then we come to find, oh, it's bone dry. And now we're finding, no, it's not. There is water ice at the lunar south pole, and there are water molecules locked up in these little volcanic glass beads. So it's become a much more interesting place. And I think that it's really a function of the era, the Apollo era communications, the sort of discussion of what the moon is, that sense of wonder was in many ways lacking. And I don't think that's going to happen with the Artemis crews. They understand the wider import of the moon. And I think they can kind of re-enchant the moon for us as they travel on this mission, which is not a landing, of course, and they'll just go on a flyby 10-day mission using gravity to bring them back. So there's they have a free return, as they say. And I think they're going to bring the moon down to us in a way that Galileo did, and give us that sense of factual wonder.
That's so interesting that you refer to the Apollo missions as being done with the moon. I remember this. I remember how we sort of pushed the Apollo missions aside. And as a kid, I even was saying, wait, aren't we going back? What do you mean we're done with the moon? And there's probably a lot of stuff up there that we'd love to know about. What currently excites you, or maybe even concerns you, most about the future of lunar exploration, and including the Artemis program, and let's even throw in private space programs.
That's the key, Scott. I'm excited, and there is a note of caution. And one of the reasons why I want people to, get their telescopes out and go to their library and borrow a telescope and look at the moon is to understand that it is the common inheritance of all humanity. The Outer Space Treaty makes it clear that no nation can claim sovereignty over the moon. Well, it was written in the 1960s. Now we have private companies going there. And on the one hand, it's a very good model. President Obama started the commercial lunar payload services. So we have commercial companies, private companies landing on the moon. NASA and other science agencies are sort of renting that space. It's a good model. Capitalism is good at innovation. And I think the Artemis program, as it is laid out, and Congress has pushed back against the White House cuts. And so I think the Artemis program will probably be tweaked. It's a slower pace than Apollo. I think that's actually more sustainable. So, exploration science at its best, going to these places that you can see through an eyepiece of a telescope, you can see where human beings will go to the moon and land in a few years. But that question of how do we balance the science and exploration side of this with the common human inheritance of the moon. The moon is not owned by anybody, so in a sense, it belongs to all of us, with the possibility of over-exploitation of that water ice. How will we regulate that? Who profits from that? Are we going to trash, visually trash, certain parts of the moon? How do we prevent that? And I say this, the last thing I'll say is, like, we are surrounded by very pressing, very difficult questions in our culture today. We're facing a lot of wicked problems. And so why should we even think about, well, what would this part of the moon look like after we get done, mining water out of it? Well, it's a chance to get things right, and it's a chance to learn cooperation, and it's a chance not just to sort of explore a place and learn science and inspire people, but it might be a place where we actually do have settlements, where we actually sort of perfect the art of solving problems without creating new ones. So that's my hope.
Maybe it says something about the hope and inspiration and getting it right, like you say, or maybe it says something about actually caring about our people who are going to be in that vessel going out.
Yeah. Artemis started under the first Trump administration, really, frankly, led by Vice President Pence and a guy named Scott Pace, a policy leader. And it was continued under Biden. Now it's back. And so it has strong bipartisan support. Just last week, Congress restored all the funding just about that the White House Office of Management and Budget had wanted to cut. And so you've got this weird situation where you've got the White House and then the OMB acting like kind of a rogue, you know, agency saying, we want to cut, cut, cut. Not a lot of leadership from the White House on that. Congress came back and said, nope, we're fully funding this. So this is one of those rare instances where bipartisan support is very strong. And I want to shout out to the Planetary Society, which is a nonprofit organization devoted to promoting space exploration and space science. Tens of thousands of messages, hundreds of activists pushing Congress to restore that funding. And so that is an example of how public pressure can work. Again, we're at a time where that kind of civic involvement is necessary across a whole lot of issues.
One question I wanted to ask you before we go is about the re-entry. So you mentioned you're going to Cape Canaveral to see the launch. Will it be just as interesting to see that re-entry? And are there, because of the way that you describe it, and I know they did a test on it, but do we know what's going to happen? Because it's really never been done before, right?
It's fraught. I think anyone who tells you that that either launch or reentry are just, you know, standard operating procedure, you know, that, and they wouldn't worry, I think they're wrong. I'm very confident in the launch vehicle. Again, as a writer, I'm not an engineer, but I've been writing about this for a few years now, and the Space Launch System has come under a lot of criticism, but it flew on its first flight and it was flawless. Okay, it was perfect, and unlike the space shuttle, they have a jettison system. You know, so if something goes wrong at launch, they can jettison the capsule away from the launch vehicle. And, you know, so I'm less concerned about that reentry. I think we all just have to trust that these four astronauts who were deeply involved in, you know, reviewing the heat shield issues, they would not have signed off on this. You know, they have kids, they have families. They would not say, yeah, we're ready to do this if they thought it was unsafe. But reentry is, it's fraught because you can't talk to them. You know, the heat of the reentry creates plasma. The plasma cuts off the communication. So there'll be several minutes whenever the splashdown, reentry and splashdown occur, where we're not going to be hearing from them. So hearkening back to Apollo, if anyone's interested in Norman Mailer, the novelist, wrote a book about Apollo called A Fire on the Moon. And he is very skeptical, a very skeptical narrator in this book. But then he goes to the launch and even he is just like, you know, moved by that experience. Speaking of, you know, the sublime. So I'm looking forward to that.
Christopher Kokinos is our guest. He has written the book Still as Bright, and we've been enjoying this conversation so much. So thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
It's been great. Thank you, guys.